So it's super nice to be here with so many friends and colleagues. And today, there does not seem to be a difference between a friend and colleague. So there's something about this birthday party for the Bauhaus that produces a kind of intimacy amongst scholars. And as Beatrice perfectly pointing out, this has its risks. And it seems to me there are many risks in the birthday parties in general, and especially of Bauhaus. So just to begin, more or less, where Beatrice left off with Gropius here at the front, and with his inaugural address of 1919, where he says, "We find ourselves in a colossal catastrophe of world history, in a transformation of the whole of life and the whole of inner man. Many students have just returned from the battlefield. Those who've survived a meeting with death came home basically altered. Since I most partially empathize, having been himself intimate with death, with all of this, I do not wish to employ any coercion on my part." Of course, the reason he's saying this is to coerce. So he's using this trick of saying, it will be too difficult for me to tell you what to do. You must tell yourself what to do, what I'm about to tell you that you will tell yourself to do. And this was Gropius, a politician, completely political. Also the moment, this moment of 1919, of course, is not an accidental moment in the beginning of a debate about Bauhaus that will be continuous and probably continuous today. But essentially his argument at a theoretical level is that there has been a fragmenting of the body, the brain, of the economy, of social life that call for at least a kind of prosthetic logic or the beginning of the construction of the new man. The explicit agenda of Bauhaus is to design a new kind of human. It is not a place for the designing of lamps and chairs, but people. And this must begin with an undoing of whatever is left of the human. So all of the strategies, the pedagogical strategies, are to, as it were, remove all the last traces of the old human, to, as Itten put it, to unlearn. So he had basically strategies of unlearning as the key, to lose all of your assumptions, which would then be followed by the workshops. You could enter the workshops when you had been stripped of your previous humanity, and the workshop would be a laboratory in which you, as a kind of proto-human, would work together to make the new human. This arc, by the way, from a kind of super experimental transformation of the human to a laboratory, to a kind of place of production, this arc that every student was supposed to follow could also be described as the arc of the whole Bauhaus itself, as it has a much more experimental beginning, followed by a much less experimental end, seen to be closer to the world of production and to industry. All of the perversity and complexity and conflict and hybridity that Beatrice was beautifully showing were super suppressed, repressed, to produce a particular image of the Bauhaus. In other words, the secret of the Bauhaus is a form of perversion, but to make that secret operational in the world, it must be repressed. So there's a double move of transgression and then the suppression of that transgression. And the repressed image of the Bauhaus, of Bauhaus design, went viral beyond the beliefs of Gropius or any of the other members of that community, which means that actually we cannot simply speak about the Bauhaus. There is no simple conversation that we could have about the Bauhaus. It has affected the very way we speak, even the word politics. This question, how political is the Bauhaus, it's not clear. We would normally think of the Bauhaus as the small category and politics as the large category, but we probably have to ask first the question, how Bauhaus is politics? Because if politics is now organized by a certain way of thinking that was indoctrinated and dispersed from the Bauhaus, when we ask the question, how political is the Bauhaus, we may already be trapped in the Bauhaus way of thinking. And this may seem too big a claim for me to make, but at least we should hesitate and consider the possibility that there is no conversation possible today about the Bauhaus, that about politics, which doesn't involve several layers of Bauhaus indoctrination already, which we would have to strip away, unlearn through various perverse procedures, of which this conference might be one. I was thinking this could be a purging event, or at least the first session of this conference could be the purging moment. Anyway, you have the Bauhaus in your pocket, of course. in your phone that in its smoothness and compactness is operating in every way in the Bauhaus. It is an object and full of secrets, secrets that you don't want to know. It's not accidentally from the Bauhaus. Steve Jobs went to the campus at Aspen Institute, designed by Herbert Bayer, and listened to a lecture by an apprentice from the Bauhaus and was absolutely convinced that the Bauhaus logic would be the logic of his company, and then returned to the Aspen Institute to make a famous explanation of the logic of a Bauhaus product. So the fact that the phone in your pocket has all of the characteristics of Bauhaus' aesthetics and logic and explanation and industrial procedures and its ambitions to produce a new man are obvious. What's not so obvious is how successfully this object is a new man. In fact, when I said it's in your pocket, it would be much more correct to say that you are inside its pockets. In every possible sense, or that is to say, the you that's constructed in that phone is much more you than you, and now one's life is to, as it were, aspire to the you that is something like other yous inside you. Of course, we don't really want to know what's inside the phone. We want to think of it as very personal and to stroke it. We don't want to think about the largest holes on the planet that have been dug, usually under quasi-military or slave-like conditions, to produce this object in your pocket. You don't want to know to what extent that object in your pocket is part of a much more splendid Bauhaus design, this ozone hole, which has been produced with such collaborative efforts by all of us over the last century or so. We certainly don't want to consider the possibility of sort of death through design, of which this seagull is just a perfect example. We don't want to think of all of this. In fact, that's what makes the phone in your pocket a Bauhaus object, that its smooth surface is a kind of anesthetic device to hide from you the absolutely radical transformation of your body and your brain and the planet and so on that has been acted out from this. Of course, it sounds like I'm crediting the Bauhaus with too much authority, and to do so in Germany might seem like even a kind of strange nationalism in this of all moments. And it is true, of course, that the Bauhaus was itself part of a longer history. The Bauhaus under Gropius was the kind of culmination of at least 100 years of discourse about design, and it was the English that started to first use this word design in this way, design in the face of industrialization. So there was 100 years of debate about what would be the role that design could play in the face of industrialization. And the Bauhaus was really not so much the invention of anything as the kind of condensation and marketing and packaging of that thing. It's important to point out that 100 years of debate about what would be design in the face of industry was explicitly nationalist. It was a political debate from the very, very beginning. It began with the jealousy of the English towards what would be the Prussian and French success with design. By the end of the century, it had reversed to be a German jealousy of the English capacity to think in the world of design. So the Bauhaus is a kind of a product of this nationalism. Gropius, of course, is only sitting in the Bauhaus and was designated as the director of the Bauhaus by van der Velde, who himself had to leave because he was not German. So explicitly, even the very gesture, the very opening gesture, the choice of director had to do with a nationalist debate. Of course, this is the famous quote of Gropius, again, of 1919, that if we admit politics to the Bauhaus, it will collapse like a house of cards. I've already announced my intention to prevent any and all politics from entering the Bauhaus. This highly political statement is specifically made in an attempt to counter the beginnings of the anti-Bauhaus discourse. That is extremely important, and of course Gropius himself very much aligned with the Social Democrats, and therefore this is a very particular move. He's looking to suppress his own politics in the name of defending the school, and defending the school against what? A very, very familiar argument from the beginning and to the end. The Bauhaus was under continuous attack, first in Weimar and then in Dessau and then ultimately in Berlin, for being, and these are the words used, from the beginning, from 1919, sick, Jewish, alien, insane, homeless, communist, non-German, anti-German, the product of inferior races. This is the language. No kidding, this is what Gropius is responding to. His political agency was to declare in that moment precisely that the Bauhaus was not political. This is the political maneuver, which is extremely complicated. He's trying to appease the right by designing an image of the Bauhaus, and I would like to insist here in partnership with Beatrice that the image of the Bauhaus was itself a Bauhaus product. In other words, in fact, much more significant than the production of any particular product in the Bauhaus is the Bauhaus itself as a product, a kind of smooth image that veils complexity, contradictions, and complicities, just as the outside of your phone does tell you nothing about really the how the phone operates and you don't want to know. Likewise, the image of the Bauhaus tells you actually nothing about how the Bauhaus operates or its ambitions. The main agent of this suppression, and you see as it were here, Gropius looking at you with that sort of seriousness. He has a slightly soft jacket because he's human, soft, but the tie is well tied. He's kind of a technocrat. He seems to be holding, perhaps it's a cigar. He's thoughtful. He looks at you directly. He's a man, which of course means he's infinitely wise and to be trusted. He's slightly at an angle because he's at ease where he is, but he's looking you in the face. Bauhaus, clean, right? Clean. On the right, 1930, not so clean or more clean. But 1930 is a very particular moment, of course. In that moment, Gropius is engineering the removal of Hannes Meyer. Hannes Meyer, you see on the left in 1928, and on the right in 1930, a few months before he will be removed. Removed for which crime? The crime of politics. Precisely, in other words, to sort of, as it were, return the Bauhaus to the fantasy, the political fantasy of a non-political life. The agency for the production of an image of the Bauhaus, a kind of depoliticized image, a successfully depoliticized image of the Bauhaus, is the 1930 exhibition of the German Deutsche Werkbund within the Paris exhibition of the decorative arts. An astonishing display assembled by Gropius in collaboration with Mahalinaj, Herbert Meyer, and Marcel Breuer. And as you can see, it's a kind of tour de force. It's an astonishing exhibition. What's amazing about this exhibition, with the exception of the Breuer furniture and with some of the Schlemmer, there's nothing of the Bauhaus in the exhibition. So it's a pure demonstration of a total environment, a total Bauhaus environment, but in fact all the objects in it have been chosen for the fact that they could have been produced in the Bauhaus, but they were not. So you could actually use this exhibition as a demonstration that the Bauhaus was no good for anything and the world could have got on fine without it. In fact, it gets turned into a Bauhaus exhibition that, of course, is explicitly removing the fact that Hannes Meyer, the Bauhaus, is in that state of flux. It's a media campaign complete with a movie theater within the exhibition, extensive coverage, of course, in the official magazines of the Werkbund, and an astonishing catalog by Herbert Bayer, which, of course, has the same color. And it's a catalog just as much about the exhibition itself as is what is displayed in the exhibition and in the catalog. As Philip was pointing out to me, Mahalinaj speaks as if the Bauhaus is finished, is gone. So it's a kind of preemptive placing of putting the Bauhaus asleep so that a new image of the Bauhaus could be produced. That image then gets reinforced. And the 1938 exhibition carried out by Herbert Bayer and Walter Gropius and Isa Gropius at the Museum of Modern Art, where once again it's the design of the exhibition itself that is the main contribution. But in this case, almost everything in the exhibition is from Bauhaus, but not from the beginnings of Bauhaus and not from post-Gropius. So these are celebrations by Gropius, of Gropius, for Gropius, in a kind of religion of Gropius. Certainly a super interesting exhibition, and once again, Herbert Bayer is also designing the catalog in this way. So let's just say, at least in 1930, the kind of fake argument of the non-politics politics of the Bauhaus is really established by the 1930 exhibition and then the 1938 exhibition, and this is the image of the Bauhaus that will become dominant. But of course, it's important to remember that the Bauhaus building itself was the first exhibition of this strategy. In other words, the very building within which the Dessau Years Were Housed was the first polemical attempt to produce a kind of clean image of the Bauhaus. And it's not by accident that in 1930 is also the year in which Gropius publishes, again as an attack on Meyer, a kind of book about all of the buildings that he had built in Dessau. So in 1930, in the same month that Meyer is being removed, is published this book designed by Mahalinaj, which features, of course, the canonic photographs of the Bauhaus by Lucia Mahalinaj, and you see, of course, one of them here. And of course, the whole point here is that this great building, this great glass building, this great glass blocks in which there would be no secrets, in which we can operate in this way, you can't see anything in this glass. Right? The very point of these photographs, that this is glass that you cannot see through, in image after image, all of which were reproduced, stolen, in fact, from Lucia Mahalinaj, all of these images actually make thematic, highlight the fact that you can't see in. Even when she takes a photograph through the corner of the workshops, you would think that you would see something in, but actually you just see more of the glass. You get kind of trapped in the glass. And all of these photographs, including this one, which are published in the very same book by Gropius, just accentuate the fact that this glass does not lead you to understand anything about what happens inside the school. In fact, you get kind of caught up, as in this photograph by Lux Feininger, you get kind of caught up in the facade itself, and there are endless photographs which celebrate the fact that one never can quite get through this glass, and even the kind of thickness of the glass. Even Gropius himself will publish frames from a movie in which the frame of the movie itself seems to even emphasize even more the fact that this glassy box is not even a box at all, but just a kind of thick layer, a layer in which the students are literally trapped or caught. Right? To be a student at the Bauhaus is not to be in the school, but in the facade of the school, to, as it were, be the facade of the school, whether male or female. And in fact, it becomes the face of the students. In this case, the face of the kind of wall, the facade as the face. Or in this case, maybe it's not so much the glass, but the balconies. And of course, Lucia Mahalinaj is also focusing on the balconies. And it's important to remember how often we do see photographs of, as it were, the rear of the building rather than the front of the building, or more precisely, the area where the students are living. You see it, for example, in Herbert Beyer's introduction card to the opening of the Bauhaus building, in which it's actually the student balconies which push forward, not the glass. You see it also in 1926 when he makes an advertisement for Dessau, what the Bauhaus is offering Dessau to go alongside the military aircraft factory is the student building. On the right, the 1927 prospectus for the students. Again, the Bauhaus is primarily those balconies. Even the book of Gropius, the very first image that we meet of the Bauhaus building is the one on the right, in which it's the white block of the students with the balconies, which is foregrounded. The very same image, which would be abstracted by Meyer, you see there on the left, as the kind of introduction to the building. So even in the 1930 exhibition, which is so influential in producing a certain image of the Bauhaus, the building itself is primarily the student balconies with, as it were, the rest of the building behind it. And if you think I'm exaggerating, this is how you would have experienced the model of the building in the 1932 show. Again, in the 1930 show, you first meet, as it were, the rear. It was very much the case when the model was shown in 1938 in Museum of Modern Art, where you would encounter the exhibition by encountering the student balconies. And it was, of course, the cover, again, Herbert Beyer's cover of the exhibition catalog, which give us those balconies. Of course, this image is taken from this photograph, which is used for Schlemmer's 1927 performance, Building as a Stage, and Schlemmer will narrow it down and paint it like this. But Schlemmer's idea that the Bauhaus stage was the outside of the building, not the inside of the building, this was kind of a late idea on his part, 1927 idea. It had been the stage from the very beginning. Here we are looking at those balconies, and even it's a photograph from one part of the building looking towards the other part of the building in which we see a photographer photographing people down below. So this is a photograph of somebody photographing people on the balcony. And if you think about it, we are deluged by images of students on these balconies. And this is sort of, you could think of this as the sort of Instagram, sort of the social media of the students. These are the only images we have of the students not working. All of the images of exercise, of parties, are very much working parties. But these images are in every official publication, every official brochure. They include often masters as well as students. They're often taken by masters. Some of the Mahalinaj, Feininger, and so on are there. Breuer is inside the photograph. Mahalinaj is inside of the photograph. So we look at them as students, like on the not been trained as architects or artists, or they are like off duty. But in fact, the off-duty image becomes the most powerful image of the Bauhaus. And you can see it's a kind of, it's as if the students are not inside this building, but on the facade working up. There's a kind of vertical space which they're negotiating, jumping down, climbing up. There's an almost obsessive kind of caressing of the facade of the building constructed by the students in this way, looking down, looking up, in this photograph, even somebody reaching out. And perhaps it was not by accident that that last image of Hannes Meyer at the Bauhaus, just before he's getting the axe, it seems that one of the students is looking up to see what's happening. I imagine the axe is kind of coming down the facade, because that facade is the real Bauhaus. But by the way, of course, there is the crime that the political crime of Hannes Meyer is communism in the kind of official record. And since he saw architecture as a form of biology, as a form of scientific research, it's assumed that as a scientist he must be boring. This is a big mistake. This is Hannes Meyer wearing a metal shirt at the metal party, clasping somebody, maybe a man, maybe a female, but definitely an architect, holding the magazine Bauen. This is not an accidental shirt. We look more closely. It could fit into Beatrice's lecture. He's in love with that shirt. Right? This is not exactly a communist shirt. And this gives us a kind of a clue. Of course, the communist students very much protest the rejection of Hannes Meyer, not only because politically they aligned themselves with him, but they also very, very well understood that he was in fact not removed for his communism, but for a series of very classical debates. Here is the Bauhaus 3 issue that comes out after in solidarity with his removal, in which they are very much aware that Gropius, Kandinsky, and Elbers had conspired to remove Hannes Meyer because of his threat to the world of art, to the hierarchy of art versus technology, and in particular to the idea of student self-government. In other words, not communism per se, but literally kind of pedagogical, a more horizontal pedagogy, the very horizontal pedagogy that they had always claimed. So what am I arguing here? I'm arguing that actually the real school, the real Bauhaus, is not inside the building but outside. And this was very much understood by Gropius. The reason the students are all hanging on the facade looking out, because the real school is out there. The viral success of the Bauhaus does not depend on some very, very important pedagogical experiments going on in Weimar and then in Dessau and then in Berlin and then being exported. From the beginning, from the very, very beginning, from 1919, there was an alternative school that was being, as it were, promoted to the world very successfully. And it is those of us who were receiving this knowledge that were the students of this school, not the students who were inside. In fact, the students inside the school were teachers, and the slippage from student to teacher, which is very much a trademark, the kind of incestuous nature of that slippage, is in fact in the nature of this event. This kind of campaign was, of course, supported by media expertise, specifically Mahalinaj and Herbert Beyer, starting with the 1923 catalog of the 23 exhibition, again done as an attempt to kind of appease the right successfully, and the catalog designed by Mahalinaj with Herbert Beyer doing the cover, then the series of books that start coming out in 1925, the famous Bauhaus books designed by Mahalinaj. But if the real school is outside, the converse is also true, that the inside is not necessarily a school. Listen to the words of one of the students protesting when Walter Gropius announces his resignation. The student says, "Even though we haven't always agreed with you, you are still our guarantee that the Bauhaus will not become a school." Right? For the sake of an idea, we have starved here at the Dessau. You cannot leave now. So actually, the real threat posed by Hannes Meyer is that he would start a school, right? Which he did. Obviously. Meyer had to be expunged for making a school. And remember, this is the Hannes Meyer, just to remind you, the Hannes Meyer of the silver shirt, 1923. What are the main things that a scientific architect, a biological architect, needs to consider when designing a house. Number one, sex life. Number two, sleeping habits. Number three, pets. Number four, gardening. Number five, personal hygiene. And then after that, it's about the weather, right? So this is not somebody that's so easily categorized. So again, just to sort of finish this point, for Gropius, the Bauhaus was never simply inside the Bauhaus. The Bauhaus itself was, even the institution, even the pedagogy, something like your phone, a kind of smooth, shiny device. The Bauhaus is an idea, never anything other than an idea. The specific idea, that is to say the engagement with the mass industrial economy, was never successful at the Bauhaus, but is frighteningly, the very same idea, frighteningly successful today. In other words, the Bauhaus idea got realized, but the Bauhaus itself never achieved that. That is to say the idea of good design, and good design being design that is divorced from politics. So divorced from politics, that Herbert Bayer could work for 10 years on Nazi propaganda from 1928 to 1937, including leaflets for the Hitler Youth, and was able to continue to do so even during the period that the building, that the swastika was hanging on the Bauhaus building itself in this way. He only stopped doing propaganda for the Nazis when one of his own paintings was included in the Degenerate Art Show in Munich, and then Walter Gropius stepped in to extract him across to the United States with the specific purpose that he would come to design the 1938 issue exhibition at the Bauhaus that Walter Gropius and his wife Isa Gropius was forming. And this was not an easy gesture, not because it was hard to get somebody out of Germany, but it was hard because Bayer had had such a long affair with the wife of Walter Gropius. And so for the three of them to negotiate this issue. But again, following Beatrice's lecture, nothing could seem more normal than for the three of them to do this. So again, the Bauhaus, from this perspective, condensed 100 years of debate about design in the face of industrialization. It refined it, it packaged it into a smooth aesthetic. It's not a situation, and I would suggest not a situation today, that the right is simply on the outside and the left is on the inside. It was, to say the least, never simply one school. I mean, this is the very beginnings of constructing a marketable image of the Bauhaus, that it's the Bauhaus rather than many Bauhauses. The external repression launched from the very, very beginning, and a kind of preemptive repression. So Gropius is repressing the transgressions that he hasn't even initiated yet. So even before Itten is hired, he's already beginning to repress possible reactions to transgression. So he's both feeding the transgressions and preparing the kind of external repression. That external repression became an internal repression. The school sort of started to censor itself, normalize itself in the name of industry. In that sense, it was no longer a radical pedagogy, to use Beatrice's way of understanding the countercultural pedagogical techniques of the 1960s. No longer was the Bauhaus operating as a transgressive side of experimental work. It was simply servicing a global economy where capital and biology had become the very medium of design. And in this particular moment, when you can design your children, much as they would like to design you, now you can design them. The question is really, can the story be reverse engineered? Can the perversions, the violations of norms, the secret life of the norm, be reactivated for completely different political ends? And to do so, my suggestion is just one, that I think we first have to understand to what extent politics has become a design craft, theorized as such. There is hardly a politician on the planet that doesn't portray herself or himself as the kind of architect of a particular kind of construction. And once again, it's very perfectly framed as the construction of a new and better kind of human. But this remains our question, are we human?